Welcome to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu, brought to you by BAE Systems. Each week, Jared will speak one-on-one with Department of Defense senior managers discussing policies and programs affecting warfighters and how the military meets its mission. On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now, your host, Jared Serbu.
Thanks for listening to On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. When it comes to military medicine, necessity is often the motherhood of invention, and those inventions often turn into things the civilian healthcare world can't do without. The First and Second World Wars brought penicillin. The Korean and Vietnam Wars brought us modern air evacuation and vascular surgery. And Dr. Jonathan Woodson, the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs, says the Iraq and Afghanistan wars are still teaching lessons to the civilian healthcare community. Woodson is our guest for the full hour, which we'll spend predominantly on the topic of military medicine's contribution to those of us who aren't wearing uniforms. Later in the show, we'll talk about the impact of sequestration on the overall military health system. Woodson is a vascular surgeon. His last job before coming to government was as the senior attending vascular surgeon at Boston Medical Center and professor of surgery at Boston University. We'll begin our discussion in Boston, where the lessons military doctors learned about blast injuries tragically became relevant on U.S. soil during the recent bombings.
There's these now iconic photos that I think everyone's seen by now of a couple of reserve component soldiers, National Guard, I think, jumping in the immediate aftermath. But that assistance from the military has continued, right, in a lot of different ways over the ensuing weeks and months. Talk us through some of what DoD's contribution in the aftermath of that event has been.
Yes, so there have been a lot of back-channel discussions about how the military has treated similar blast injuries. We've learned a lot over more than a decade of war. Boston, of course, is near and dear to my heart. That's where my home is.
Right.
And prior to coming here, I was a professor and dean at Boston University. So had I been there, I would have probably taken care of some of those casualties, and it would have been full circle. And so certainly our hearts go out to the victims in Boston and Boston in general. But there's an interesting story to be told here, and it's about this issue of how during periods of war advances are made in medicine that benefit all of civil society. During the interwar years, there's continued improvements, and then during renewed periods of conflict, we often pick up on these again and make further advances. I think it was Hippocrates who said that he who wants to be a surgeon should go to war. And the other interpretation of that is he who wants to be a surgeon should join the army and follow it. And what he was speaking of, really, way back when, was the fact that, unfortunately, during war, there are many casualties. There is a lot of disease and non-battle injuries, which physicians can learn from, again, to benefit society at large. And so this has been a pattern of events throughout history. In American history, we can look at, catapulting change in medicine as we look at the different war eras. The Civil War, we saw advances in strategies for evacuating the battlefield, creation of medical records, rapid amputation, oddly enough, at that time. In World War I, we started fielding surgical units, laboratory transfusion and shock. World War II, we saw the advances in the use of antibiotics, penicillin and sulfur. Even the first use of dialysis. In the Korean War, we saw advances of the use of the helicopter as an evacuation strategy that saved lives. The ability to clear the battlefield at that time rapidly and get victims of trauma, servicemen, to definitive care center also allowed the advances in certain surgical techniques because the wounds were not as infected and contaminated, And so my own specialty, which is vascular surgery, really mm-hmm. advanced during career because we were able to do definitive arterial repairs, repair blood vessels, and reduce the amputation rates. And then on into Vietnam, we saw advances again in strategies for care of trauma victims, resuscitation, shock advances, and the extensive use of helicopters. It was during Vietnam, of course, that we trained a lot of medics with advanced medical capabilities and skills. These are the same individuals that came home to our civilian sectors in our cities and became the bases and the pillars, the first personnel that became our emergency medical technicians, paramedics, our flight medics, and the like. And that advanced, of course, our strategy for saving life in the civil sector. And so it's not unexpected that now, after a decade of war, we should see further advances that now are finding their way back into civil society. And there's got to be this bond between military medicine and civil society, between military medicine and academia, that helps generate these changes. So, you know, if war is sort of the dark side of humanity, then in some sense, military medicine and medicine in general is the light. And you see this circle of activity with every conflict.
So this is a centuries-old story of necessity being the motherhood of invention
exactly.
in the world of medicine.
Exactly.
Let's go back to where we started in Boston. You know, I think everyone, you know, would pray that we would never need the skills that we learned about blast injuries here on the homeland. But in fact, those skills that the military learned in Iraq and Afghanistan were put into play in the aftermath of that event.
Oh, absolutely. We've learned a lot about blast events over the last decade. So when a blast occurs, an IED explosion occurs, it causes injuries in a number of ways, and one needs to be sensitive to this so that when you get a victim of a blast injury in, you can understand and anticipate the full spectrum of injuries that might accrue. So there's the blast itself, which creates an overpressurized wave, which causes blunt injury, causes the brain to rattle around in the skull, and can cause direct soft tissue damage. It can cause problems with overpressurization of the lungs, bowel gas, etc., and cause injury that way. Then there is the injuries that are caused by missiles, meaning as items fragment, they become projectiles that can injure an individual. In the case of these homemade bombs that are filled with nails or other metallic objects that become missiles themselves, obviously they cause penetrating injuries. And then because the blast creates a thermal effect, it can create burns and skin and soft tissue injury as a result of burns. And then lastly, because it actually throws people, it can cause these kinds of secondary injuries as a result of a trauma, much as someone might experience in a motor vehicle accident. So there are several ways injuries can be produced as a result of a blast injury. And why do you need to know that? Because you need to look for injuries in non-obvious places. So when someone comes in and they've got an injury and, you know, they've got a mangled extremity, you also need to look at the issue of whether they've got lung issues, ear issues, ruptured tympanic membranes, which can cause secondary problems later on as they're trying to rehabilitate, whether or not they've got other embedded fragments elsewhere as a result of the blast injury.
And the physicians obviously need to know that this was the result of a blast injury. If they see someone that comes in with, as you said, a mangled limb, it's critical to know that.
Right. Well, what I'm really saying is that the physician treating individuals who have been involved in a blast injury need to pay attention not only to the obvious, but the things that are not obvious in order to prevent further death and injury.
Dr. Jonathan Woodson is our guest for the full hour on this week's On DoD. He is the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs. We'll be back to talk more about military medicine's contribution to the civilian healthcare community after a short break. This is On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu.
Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and MetLife. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government, Friday at 10 a.m., right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
Imagine starting off the day on an empty stomach. Well, thousands of our homeless neighbors do. Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of Washington is working to change that through their new Cup of Joe program. They're providing a healthy breakfast for the men and women staying in shelters every morning, and they need your help. Volunteers can bag breakfast, the perfect activity for a group. Visit CatholicCharitiesDC.org/Joe. It's true. A Cup of Joe is the perfect start to the day.
Most recent news coverage of cybersecurity issues between the U.S. and China has focused on cyber theft, but could it turn into all-out war? Basically, there are two kinds of hacking: cyber exploitation to steal information, and cyber attacks that cripple or destroy computer systems. Herb Lin, a National Research Council cyber expert, says to the victim, the initial penetration can look the same, and
this is a surefire way of escalating the conflict in ways that neither side wants to do,
potentially starting a bruising cyber war that's difficult to end.
What would you have to do to persuade the other guy that you weren't doing it anymore?
Lin says that's a very hard technical problem, and one of the issues that international cyber experts should get together to solve. To find out more about this and other engineering innovation stories, please go to www.nae.edu/radio. With the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Atkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
They say a picture is worth a thousand words. Well, picture your family and home safe and secure with Ackerman Security Systems. Picture yourself controlling your system remotely on your mobile phone anytime, anywhere. Picture yourself getting video clips and texts of happenings at home before your kids get home from school. Picture everything you can do with the money saved by choosing Ackerman Security.
There's good reason Ackerman Security Systems is the Washington area's most trusted security company. It's because at Ackerman, security is all they do, and they do it better than anyone else. For just $18.95 a month, Ackerman monitors your home for burglary, fire, and medical alert. Already have a system? Switch for free and start saving. Call by Wednesday and get up to 3 months of basic monitoring free. Call 888-999-1070. AckermanSecurity.com. With Sprint, you can do more with less. Government CIOs and other IT executives rely on Sprint to help stretch their technology dollars. Sprint offers a powerful network for connectivity virtually anywhere, plus advanced wireless solutions designed to help you manage resources effectively. Use Sprint to help get more work done. To learn more, visit Sprint.com/federal government. That's Sprint.com/federal government. Coverage not available everywhere. Restrictions apply.
Soldiers returning with traumatic brain injuries or other serious battle wounds often spend weeks or months in a VA hospital or other rehab facility. DVDs for Vets is collecting DVDs and portable players for distribution in our community and nationwide. Many of us take for granted our access to everyday enjoyments, and DVDs for Vets needs your help in giving these injured soldiers some diversions from the monotony of a hospital stay during recovery. To donate new or used DVDs or to learn more about this worthy cause, please go to www.dvdsforvets.com.
We're back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. You're listening to On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. Our guest this week is Dr. Jonathan Woodson, the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs. We're talking mostly this hour about the contributions military medicine has made to the practice of civilian health care. And Woodson says those lessons are continuing right up to the present, with practices that developed out of necessity through the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
At the outset of the Iraq and Afghanistan period, and I'm thinking specifically here about traumatic brain injury, which frequently caused by these blast waves. What did we not understand about the things that caused these injuries, and what have we come to learn since then?
So that's a very good question. So on the one hand, we understood that they could occur. I think the issue relative to the last 10 years is the frequency with which they've occurred, because remember that one of the signature strategies by the enemy, one of the way they've tried to injure our servicemen and women, is with the IED. So as much as we think about gunshot wounds as part of war, in the modern era, the IED has become one of the signature ways that our servicemen and women have been injured. The second issue is that because of strategies for caring for servicemen and women who have been injured, we have had some of the highest survival rates. And so we're seeing the secondary consequences. Many of these individuals may have, in fact, not survived their injuries in previous conflicts. And so we're seeing the second and third order effects and the late effects of this. The third thing is that because we have better strategies for treating some of the other more common injuries, we've been able to focus much better on, again, the traumatic brain injury as a signature injury. As we started out in a place where, and still are to some extent, where neuroscience is still a bit of a mystery. There are many things we don't know about how the brain works, how the brain repairs itself, what should be the most appropriate treatments. We're looking at biomarkers to try and diagnose the injury as early as possible. Up until this point, we've been relying mainly on clinical criteria. So I'll examine you as a physician, and either you won't respond to questions I give you quite right, or we'll see some neurological abnormality. Well, we know that, in fact, that that's a crude way of identifying a brain injury. What we're learning is that even though you may look all right and you may grossly have normal motion, that with imaging studies, there still could be a brain injury there. What we've also learned is that repetitive brain injuries have a crude effect. So whereas someone may recover well from a mild traumatic brain injury the first time, repetitive concussions have a crude effect.
Knowing that, knowing what we know now about that accrued effect of repetitive injuries, has that knowledge translated into how commanders approach an individual soldier, sailor, airman, marine once they know that there has been a traumatic brain injury?
Yes. In fact, based upon our understanding of that, we've fielded a Department of Defense instruction outlining how individuals who may be involved in a blast injury should be cared for. So every service member now in Afghanistan who is part of an IED event, within 50 meters of an IED event, is screened for concussive injury. And if they're found to have any signs or symptoms that may suggest a concussion, they're sent for more extensive evaluation. And if they have any persistent symptoms, they're sent to restoration centers, rest centers, where they get the appropriate rest and other therapies to allow them to heal their mild traumatic brain injury. We've even placed in theater imaging, advanced imaging centers to do brain imaging to assist with diagnosis. So there's been a well-defined now algorithm for how to treat these individuals.
Mm-hmm. In addition to being a vascular surgeon in Boston prior to taking this job, you're also an Army reservist, I believe.
That's correct.
I don't know how often or if you did deploy during Operation Iraq. Based on your own experience and what you know from this job, I wonder if you can just kind of compare where military medicine was at the outset of, say, Operation Enduring Freedom, and where we are today? What would have been the most significant changes in terms of battlefield care, if you can categorize it that way?
So I think there are several, and interesting you should ask the question that way, because I was there at the beginning when it was what we would call an immature theater.
Mm-hmm. Afghanistan, you mean?
Well, this was a really originally an Iraqi freedom, right? So really at the beginning. And then subsequently I've had an opportunity, of course, to go back to Afghanistan to see how our strategy has improved. So at the beginning, of course, as you move into that decade of war, you're really, much as I said before, transferring a lot of that civilian knowledge into sort of military practice. And what is clear is that I can remember way back when having Colonel John Holcomb come and see me really almost on the eve of the war, and we were talking the issue of a strategy for trauma care during the war. And one of the great changes that were made early on with the leadership of John Holcomb and others was the establishment of the Joint Theater Trauma System. This was an important contribution because what it recognized is that we needed a mechanism for rapidly studying the pattern of injuries, the types of injuries, and then developing improvements based upon how those casualties were handled. So the issue of tourniquets came out of those early days to field the combat action tourniquet, which has saved a number of lives, if not limbs, during the subsequent decade of war. The hemostatic bandages, the directive type memorandum on how to treat TBI, resuscitation formulas, understanding that if you give a lot of saline, patients don't do as well when they have a lot of massive blood loss, but you have to give blood component therapy rapidly. The training of medics to include advanced skills for our flight medics. These were just some of the changes that were made over the decade of war. One of the great changes that occurred was our strategy for evacuating the wounded back to what we call level four or higher advanced medical centers in a rapid period of time. As you may know, in previous conflicts, it took weeks to months to get casualties back. We were getting them back in 24 to 72 hours, and that allows definitive therapy and rehabilitation to commence sooner. And I think that's improved outcomes. So we've improved across our whole range of activities from direct field resuscitation at the time of injury through all of the echelons of care. We've brought a level of sophistication far forward and established a continuum that has brought about better outcomes.
Has it been more about, as you just said, pushing high-quality care out as far into the battlefield as you can? Is it more about evacuating people to these level four centers as quickly as you can? Is it a combination of both of those things that's made the difference?
So it is a combination of both of those things, but it's also the advanced and more rapid study of specific injuries to develop a better strategy for care. So, for example, massive hemorrhage. So if you have advanced medics on the battlefield now and they're able to apply those tourniquets and immediately save those lives by taking care of those preventable injuries that cause death, the airway, the pneumothorax, tension pneumothorax, and control the bleeding. Then when they get to the second echelon of care or the third echelon of care, then how do you sustain life at that point when all of the metabolic consequences of that massive hemorrhage have occurred? And so that's where we were able to study resuscitation formulas and refine how we give blood components in a standardized way to improve outcomes. And we even took that back to the laboratory and made improvements. And then it also developed research projects that looked at how do you develop what we call the hemostatic bandage, which are these bandages that stop bleeding more effectively. So it's a whole range of things. It's not only the strategy for care and the system of care. It is about applying technology far forward, but it's also about more intensive research efforts to define better ways of treatment of injuries.
Dr. Jonathan Woodson is the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs, our guest for the full hour during this week's On DoD. We'll be back to talk more after another break. This is On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servio.
The year was 1957. The date was October 4th. And Americans woke up to a strange new reality. The first satellite launched into space wasn't ours. The Russians had gotten there first. Sputnik 1 may have been the size of a beach ball, but it was the space shot heard round the world.
Today, a new moon is in the sky.
And it galvanized the nation into action. The Martin Company rose to meet the challenge. Then, on St. Patrick's Day, 1958, a Martin-built Vanguard rocket roared into space with the Shamrock taped to its side and put the world's first solar-powered satellite into orbit. 4 months later, the president signed the legislation that created NASA. The rest, as they say, is history. A history that is still being written by the scientists and engineers of Lockheed Martin. Their story is our story. See it unfold at LockheedMartin.com/100 years.
You don't need two washing machines.
You don't need two cappuccino makers.
Or two snowblowers.
Or two bad knees.
No, you don't need two t-shirts that say, "Kiss me, I'm Irish."
Definitely not.
And your government agency doesn't need two mobility management solutions.
It's unproductive, costly, and annoying.
Kind of like a commercial with two announcers.
Introducing the Citrix Zen Mobile Solution. The mobility management solution that gives your employees the freedom to work from anywhere on any device. And gives you the ability to secure and control devices without having to deploy multiple solutions.
With Citrix Zen Mobile, you can secure and manage your workforce devices, apps, and data from one centralized point.
Your employees get secure email, browsing, and a unified app store.
And you can isolate sensitive apps and data using Citrix Mobile App Containerization technology.
Citrix offers the only end-to-end enterprise mobility management solution you need to provide a completely flexible and secure mobile workplace.
Visit Citrix.com/U.S. government to learn more.
That's Citrix.com/U.S. government.
You always have to have the last word.
That's right.
Are you a loyal credit card user and your only reward is a high interest rate? Anyone can join State Department Federal Credit Union and take advantage of their Visa Platinum credit card. Just a 6.99% APR, plus earn one reward point for every dollar you spend. And there is no foreign transaction or balance transfer fees. Visit sdfcu.org. Annual percentage rate is based on evaluation of applicants' credit. SDFCU is federally insured by the NCUA.
Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy, sponsored by AT&T, every Tuesday morning at 11 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. Federal Tech Talk has the latest on products that help bring policy to life. Check out the world of high technology in the federal government as John speaks to CISOs, CTOs, and CIOs and gets into the specifics for federal IT systems integrators. Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy, sponsored by AT&T, Tuesday mornings at 11 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Buried in contracts that need to be awarded, pressured by urgent deadlines and tight budgets, Integrity Management Consulting Single Award GSA BPA makes it easy to relieve the stress. Integrity delivers credentialed acquisition professionals who have the experience to deal with today's challenges. Choose a partner who gives you the exact support you need, when and where you need it, nationwide. Take the pressure off by working with Integrity. Learn more at consultwithintegrity.com.
This is NIH Health Matters. I'm Joe Balintfi. HPVs, also called human papillomaviruses, are a group of more than 150 related viruses. Dr. Douglas Lowy, a cancer researcher at NIH, says HPVs cause both regular warts as well as genital infections.
And some of those infections give rise to genital warts, whereas other infections can actually give rise to cancer. There are a variety of cancers caused by HPV infection. The most prominent is cervical cancer.
About 10 years ago, researchers developed a vaccine that can help prevent HPV infection and reduce the risk of the associated cancers. For more on HPV and the HPV vaccine, visit www.cancer.gov. Health Matters is produced by NIH, part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Thanks for listening to On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. We're back with our guest, Dr. Jonathan Woodson, the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs, talking about the contributions of military medicine to the civilian healthcare world. We left off in the last segment talking about what healthcare practitioners have learned about treating traumatic brain injury from the experiences of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Let me ask the same type of question, but with regard to mental health. Mm-hmm. How have things improved over the past dozen years or so with regard to our ability to recognize these issues, treat these issues? And I would assume that this is at least in some ways related to the discussion we were having earlier with regard to TBI.
So you're right. Another good set of questions. If you'll forgive me for a moment, let me again historically sort of frame where we've been so we can understand where we're at. If you look at World War I, World War II, many of these psychological injuries were largely dismissed or attributed to willful neglect of the service member or a variety of things. Right, exactly. Shell shock was a term. The thousand-yard stare was another term. We did that because we didn't understand it, and what we didn't understand was relegated to less prominence or importance in terms of a treatment strategy. Fast forward to Vietnam, we had a number of individuals who came home deeply affected by the war, with hypervigilance, reliving their traumatic events, and we did not have a name or condition for that, and it was only after the war that the term post-traumatic stress disorder was codified and entered in as a diagnosis in 1981 into the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. So that gives you a sense of the fact that we didn't even have a proper name in the medical lexicon for it until well after Vietnam. And there have been further studies during the interwar years, but that sets the stage really for, as we moved into this decade of warfare, to better recognize this problem. And so I think when we entered this period of war, we were poised, particularly since we had higher survival rates, to see the secondary psychological effects of war. The problem was we still didn't have deep understanding of what was happening at a biochemical level or a structural level as to why some people would have PTSD versus others, nor did we have very effective treatment strategies. And so we've spent a decade trying to refine our understanding of PTSD. There still are huge gaps in understanding, but also to define what our treatment strategies should be. Now, the last thing I'll say about this also addresses the point that you were making about TBI versus PTSD. And we don't fully understand what the nexuses between that. So we know that if you're involved with an IED, a blast injury, you can have a structural injury to your brain. You can also be deeply affected psychology by that blast effect and that event which threatened your life. But the issue for us is how much of PTSD is due to a structural issue with the brain, because we know there's a fair overlap in those two diagnoses, and we're trying to sort that out now with a number of investigations that are going on. Not only sort that out, but identify the most appropriate strategies for treating these two problems long term.
I want to talk a little bit about applicability to civilian medicine. Mm-hmm. We talked earlier in the hour about the Boston bombing and the use of what we've learned about blast injury in that area. Hopefully that's we have a rare need for that kind of knowledge here in the U.S. But from what we've learned over the past 12 years, what has been brought back and pushed into civilian medicine? Is a lot of this stuff just applicable to counterinsurgency warfare, or has a lot of it made its way into day-to-day medical practice in the U.S. and elsewhere?
Well, I think a lot of it is making its way into day-to-day medical practice in the civilian sector, and I think, unfortunately, the events in Boston will accelerate that because we know we have some individual doctors who are coming down to visit the Walter Reed and to learn what else might be applicable about treating victims such as were seen in the Boston bombing. As I mentioned earlier, when you have these events, you got to look for other issues that might affect the recovery. So one of the things that we've found in service members who were in these blast events is that not only do they have the primary issues of, let's say, an amputated limb which needs to heal, for which they need rehabilitation, but if they've also got damage to the ear and have problems with equilibrium as a result of that, it makes it even that much harder for them to get up and rehabilitate. So you've got to look for and remediate those problems with ear or eye issues, which are another common sort of part of the multiply injured complex of issues you see from blast injuries. In addition, you've got to dissect out the psychological issues that we've been talking about and treat that appropriately. And then you've got to give them a sense of sort of goal-directed recovery. So one of the things that we do in our rehabilitation programs is we sit down with the individuals and say, what do you want to achieve in your life going forward, and make those the goals of rehabilitation. And that's how we've advanced these issues of the sort of sports rehabilitative programs now, where we have individuals who go out skiing, they go out swimming and surfing, some have gone out hunting. They get back to their idea of what life is like and what's productive, and that gives them obviously purpose, drive, and their goal directed. So it's a combination of strategies that relate to not only the specific treatment of wounds, but the understanding of the complex nature of these blast wounds that affect different parts of the body, including psychological health, and then developing a treatment program that addresses comprehensively all aspects of that individual's set of injuries, puts them on a pathway to meeting their goals in life.
You alluded to the rehabilitative aspects of what you do. Talk about how you work with VA to transition what you're doing and what you've learned into the VA system once these military members make that transition into the VA system.
So we work very closely with Veterans Administration. Let me just say first that many of these injured servicemen and women who are just outstanding individuals. I was just out at Walter Reed the other day, and boy, every time you go by and you talk to them, they really lift your spirits with their attitudes. But many of these individuals will stay on active duty. So 1 in 5 amputees stay on active duty nowadays. So that tells you that many of them are not ready to transition to veteran status, that they see themselves as professional soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines, and as a result, they do everything possible to rehabilitate so that they can continue in active service. But Clearly, there are a number that need to transition and want to transition to veterans status. So we work very closely with the Veterans Administration. And in fact, part of the transition when there are complex injuries is to transfer them to the polytrauma centers, I think that you've mentioned before, to continue a coordinated rehabilitation program. That not only looks at, again, healing their injuries and getting them back to a status of ability, but also begins that program that looks for the occupational training and the educational goals that they may want so that they can transition into productive lives and whatever career fields that they may want to go into.
The advances that we've had over the past 12 years that have allowed service members to survive injuries that they wouldn't have 10 or 15 years ago, would you say that the majority of that has been learned literally on the battlefield, or have those advances come through more formalized, structured research programs here in the United States that were created to address needs out there?
Actually both. You know, on the battlefield, as you indicated before, it becomes a mother of necessity to try and find what works rapidly to save lives. Sort of in the community of, again, soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines who are fiercely dedicated to each other and take a great deal of pride in performing their jobs in among the medics and corpsmen and medical folks. They do everything possible to innovate and try and save lives. And so some of that comes back from the battlefield. But as I indicated before, one of the best things that occurred early in the war was the development of this joint theater trauma system, which is really a systematic way of studying every injury to identify at the earliest possible time new strategies for improvement in care. And so we look at what happens to injured servicemen, and we rapidly make changes in either the technology applied to the situation or the training that's applied to the situation or the coordination of the system to improve outcomes. One of the signature improvements in medical care in the 10 years of war has been this very sophisticated mechanism for really having flying ICUs to be able to evacuate extraordinarily sick and ill individuals thousands of miles while providing state-of-the-art care in flight. I don't know if you can appreciate how difficult that is, but having been part of my career taking care of intensive care unit patients and having been a flight surgeon taking care of patients at altitude, 37,000 feet, with all of the gas exchange issues that occur is challenging. And so
I'm sure turbulence doesn't help.
Vibration, et cetera, noise, et cetera, heat, cold, all of these things impact your ability to take care of individuals. And when they're sick, it has more of an effect. But the issue is the systematic study has improved the skill and training of individuals, the system, the technology used to help advance care. It's amazing. We've even had a patient evacuated on what we call the extracorporeal membrane oxygenator because of a severe lung injury. That would have never been thought about a decade and a half ago. The systematic study of all of these casualties has allowed the most rapid fielding of advancements in medicine possible.
Dr. Jonathan Woodson is the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs. He's also the Director of DOD's TRICARE Management Activity. We'll come back for one more segment and focus on the effects of sequestration on the overall military medical system. After one more break, this is On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servia.
Here's Dave McClure, Associate Administrator, GSA, on the Federal Executive Forum on Secure Cloud Computing, sponsored by Blue River IT.
The ability to provision in data centers and computing environments changes rapidly in the cloud environment. It creates governance challenges, knowing who is doing what, where is your data at any moment in time. So I think we can automate and make provisioning of the services in cloud very, very efficient.
To listen to the whole program made possible by Trezza Media Group, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
Blue River IT is at the forefront of cloud computing with services for and expertise in cloud lifecycle management, from determining your cloud strategy through to deployment and ongoing support. In partnership with NetApp, the leaders in storage management, Blue River IT designs and deploys mission-critical cloud-based infrastructures that meet federal mandates. Visit BlueRiverIT.com today to learn how their cloud solutions can help your federal agency. That's BlueRiverIT.com.
Ask the CIO is brought to you by CenturyLink.
Darren Ash is the CIO of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. He says the NRC's mobility pilots are still in the early stages, but show promise.
What I like about what we've been doing is less focus about the product, because the products are going to change over time. We've been focused on the work, because ultimately that work is not going to change dramatically.
Listen to Ask the CIO Thursday mornings at 10:30 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM or anytime on federalnewsradio.com.
The secret to being successful is never slowing down. Your agency's mission doesn't have a pause button, and with CenturyLink as your trusted technology partner, you don't have to slow down. Their visionary cloud infrastructure and custom communication solutions are backed by dedicated, responsive support. Pause button not included. To learn more about how CenturyLink keeps you up and rolling 24/7, 365, visit CenturyLink.com/gov. That's CenturyLink.com/gov.
For over a century, Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Washington has served the youth in our nation's capital. The club's new STEAM initiative uses the arts to teach science, technology, engineering, and math. Today, more than ever, we need your support of STEAM. It will encourage our youth to think rather than memorize, create rather than copy, and to be resourceful rather than reserved. So visit boysandgirlsclubs.org. Send a dollar or more as an investment to help us help our kids pick up STEAM. Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Washington, great futures start here.
This message is brought to you by GEICO and Federal News Radio.
These days, federal agencies are exploring how to be more efficient, from cutting hidden costs to operating differently. Turn to Deloitte. We blend public sector experience and private sector insights to help defense and civilian agencies rethink, reduce, and restructure, all while strengthening your mission so you can stretch budgets more and your staff less. See how at Deloitte.com/federal. We help government help America.
Google scans every single picture that you upload to Google+. What it does, it learns what your family members look like. It groups photos of your family members together. It can tell if your subjects are smiling. So if you've got a subject smiling in three photos, and one photo they've got their eyes closed and are frowning, it will take the face from a good photo and paste it into the bad photo so everybody's smiling.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.
It's not always easy being a dad.
When's the fairy princess coming?
Any minute now.
What? What do you mean she's not coming?
But it's always worth it.
It's the fairy princess!
It is I!
Grooms! Zinkle Bell! Yay!
The smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life.
I know it's really you, girl. I'm just pretending for the other kids.
Take time to be a dad today. Call 877-4-DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Federal agencies siphon more than $2 trillion through financial management systems every year to ensure accuracy and efficiency when dispersing to individuals and organizations. Over the years, these systems have grown on top of each other, impeding the flow and synchronization of data. As a result, waste, fraud, and abuse are at an all-time high. Join FCA Bethesda June 20th as top agency officials discuss how financial management assets, systems, and analytics are being leveraged to improve data integrity. Register today at fcabethesda.org/JUNbreakfast.
This is Mark Amtower. I've been advising contractors for almost 30 years, and when they need agency contacts, I always recommend Carroll's GovSearch. With over 350,000 contact listings and over 1,000 government organization charts, they help you find the people you need to reach in all levels of government. Give them a try. Get a free organization chart and a sample listing from their database. Contact Gordon Peel at 703-757-8228. Carroll Publishing, bringing government to you like no other.
We're back on DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Our guest this week, Dr. Jonathan Woodson, the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs. We've been talking for most of the hour about the contributions of military medicine to the practice of medicine in the broader civilian healthcare community. We'll shift topics here on our last segment and spend a few minutes on the effect of budget cuts on the overall military medical system.
Only got a couple minutes left, and I want to spend them with you on a couple very, very near-term issues. One is I'd like you to put on your Director of TRICARE Management Activity hat for a second and tell us where we are with regard to sequestration. There was, as we began this year of budget uncertainty, some considerable doubt about whether you'd be able to pay providers through the remainder of 13. Where are we with regard to that?
So let me just say that sequestration is probably one of the most illogical ways of handling the budget that one could think of. But having said that, it has caused issues with us being more budgetarily constrained. And so we've had to keep a close eye on the budget. At this moment, we are not predicting that we won't have the ability to pay providers. We have been carefully monitoring and managing the funds available to us, and we're very hopeful and expect that we'll get through this year without a major lapse in funds to pay providers. Next year, of course, if sequestration and a continuing resolution continues, it becomes even more difficult to manage the budget because you have an accrued effect. Where I'm concerned about the budget is and its effect is that as a result of needing to reallocate money, we have cut back somewhat on our funding of the research. And so as we've just had this very involved discussion about advances in medicine, we need to continue that strategy because there are still things we need to learn and we need to improve in terms of our strategy for caring for not only victims of the current conflicts, but any future conflicts that might come down the road. And so I'm very concerned about the issue of making sure we have adequate funds going into next year to continue our research effort. And then finally, I think the issue of sequestration, you know, it will have a negative effect on our personnel, particularly our civilian personnel who are subject to furloughs. Civilian personnel make up about 40% of our ability to deliver care. They are an important and skilled and committed part of our total force. And when you have to furlough someone and reduce their salaries by 10 to 20%, that has significant impact. These are people who pay mortgages, who have to send their kids to college, who need to, of course, have reliable incomes. And because they're skilled, they have other choices. And so those are the major concerns I have about sequestration going forward. Is the second and third order effects of having to do sort of illogical budget cuts, particularly in the latter half of the year.
Earlier in the year, I think there was some discussion that in order to, you know, continue to pay providers and do all the other things TRICARE does, that you would need to effectively stop medical research in 13. Is it as bad as that, or is it better described as a curtailing?
Well, I think we won't stop all medical research. What we will do is maybe not start new projects, as many new projects this year. We may have to cut back on some of the funding of existing projects, but we won't stop. And in fact, we've tried not to do that because we don't want to irreparably damage our research infrastructure. So we're hoping that, Congress will, in fact, understand what is needed, that is predictable funding, and that we will be able to continue on next year and not suffer irreparable damage to our research enterprise.
Dr. Woodson, I hate to leave things on a down note, but we're going to have to leave it there. It's been a really fascinating hour. Thanks so much for doing this with us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And Dr. Jonathan Woodson is the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs. He was good enough to join us for the full hour on this week's edition of On DoD, which we spent predominantly talking about the contributions military medicine has made to the broader world of healthcare over the past decade or so and over the past couple centuries. That is going to do it for this week's edition of On DoD. Very glad you could join us this week. Please tune in again next week. I'm Jared Servant. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu, brought to you by BAE Systems. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, Wednesday afternoons at 2, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.